In the mid-1990s, India had just two billionaire families whose fortunes amounted to a measly $3 billion. In the next couple of decades, as India enjoyed an unprecedented economic boom, the number of Indian billionaires ballooned to 120, with a collective worth of $450 billion. Now, India's newly minted billionaires, who some have dubbed the Bollygarks, don't hide their wealth like previous generations of super rich. Far from it. In fact, in megacities like Mumbai, where most of the population live in slums, India's new dynasties flaunt their extraordinary riches, funneling profits from their huge conglomerates into lifestyles of highly conspicuous consumption. My next guest, James Crabtree, spent 5 years in India as Mumbai bureau chief for the Financial Times, and in that time he met the wealthiest of India's nouveau riche, delving deep into billionaire psychology as well as their business backgrounds. And his research became the basis for the book The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age. In August this year, I spoke to James and began by asking him how he came to be in Mumbai at such a pivotal moment in the country's history.
Luck, I suppose. I had always wanted to be a foreign correspondent. I came to it relatively late in life. I used to work for the British government and for other newspapers and magazines. But the idea of being a foreign correspondent in India is kind of the dream job, I think, for many journalists who are interested in foreign countries. India is a fascinating place at the best of times. But I happened to go there at a moment of extraordinary transition. And so I arrived in 2011 and stayed for 5 years. And that was a period in which the super rich in India were accumulating wealth like never before in the country's history. And it was happening before my eyes. And as you said, I was lucky enough to get to meet a number of these billionaire tycoons and get to know them a little bit. And so that was why I decided to try and tell their stories in this book.
Did they want their stories told?
Some of them are reclusive, I think it would be fair to say, but India is quite a talkative place. I mean, it's almost the talkative Indian is almost a cliche, but India is an open society like America or Australia. You have pretty good access. You can go and meet these people. You can ask them questions. It's not like China or Japan, maybe, where it's more difficult. So I felt I got pretty good access. I got to know a number of the people that I profile in the book, the big characters, and that's the fun of writing about them, that that these are amazing people who are spending enormous amounts of money, both in their personal lives and in the investments that they're making, and so writing their stories was great fun.
The Gilded Age in New York led to all those spectacular mansions up and down Fifth Avenue, but there's nothing in that era to compare with Ambani's skyscraper home. Tell us about that.
So this building is on the front cover of some of the editions in the book. It's called Antilia. When I lived in Mumbai, I used to drive past it most days. It's a skyscraper, 170 meters tall, so it should have 70 stories. It actually only has 27 because they're all triple height. And it's a family home for five people. Mr. Ambani, who's India's, well, he's Asia's richest man now. He's worth $45 billion. He's a tycoon in areas like petrochemicals, oil refining, and telecoms, and his wife and their three kids. And they live in this extraordinary building, which, as you say, even if you look at all of the other rich cities in the world, Sydney, Moscow, London, New York, nowhere on earth is there a building as remarkable as this one. They call it the first billion-dollar home. And so it stands in all of its absurd excess in a city where, as you said in your introduction, half of the population of Mumbai still live in slums. And you have one man who lives in a home that is known as the billion-dollar home. And in a sense, that was the central metaphor of my book, that in India, something very remarkable is going on, that you have accumulation of wealth that can result in such a building in a country that is still quite poor. The average Indian doesn't yet earn $2,000 US a year, and yet you have wealth of this sort. And so it's a remarkable thing that is happening in India right before our eyes.
I remember walking in its vicinity when it was being built, and there were late at night, and there were hundreds sleeping on the footpath, usually on flattened cartons. And I remember stepping gingerly over one bloke who only had one possession, and it was a toothbrush with hardly a bristle left. So it's not just the contrast, it's the shamelessness of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at it in a mildly more positive way, that in a sense, Mr. Ambani is so famous in India that it's like being a prince, and people often describe this as a vertical palace. And so I think the reason why he built this was partly the ostentatious display of wealth, but I think it's also a desire to have privacy in a city in which it's very difficult to have privacy. So I think you can make a moral judgment about a house like this. I think it is obscene that in a country this poor that people have ridiculous homes of this sort. But nonetheless, you know, people have ridiculous homes in Sydney and New York. And so there are problems of inequality everywhere. But there is something peculiar about the expression of this in a country like India, where you have these real chasms of wealth and the role that wealth plays in a society that is that early in its development path, that is sort of simply even more pronounced than the high extremes of wealth that we have in countries like Australia or Britain.
I'm talking to James Crabtree about his book, The Billionaire Raj, which comes with a rave recommendation from our old mate William Dalrymple, among others. And into the title, you've woven A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age, which, of course, takes us back to the United States. Draw the parallels. I suppose some of these characters are the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers.
That's exactly right. So the American Gilded Age ran from the end of the Second World War, the Civil War, 1865, to about the turn of the century. And so this was the era of the robber barons. These are the great tycoons, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, Rockefeller. It was also the era of Tammany Hall politics in New York, very corrupt urban governance. But really what was happening was this was an era in which America was going very, very quickly from being an agrarian society to being an urban one, and with the development of the middle class that came with that. So Chicago at the end of the Civil War had a population of 90,000. At 1900, it had a population of above 1 million. And although the analogy is imprecise, India is going through a similar phase of early industrialization in which it has robber baron tycoons making tons of money, gross corruption in its politics, and the same underlying structural transformation. It's even more vast in India. The urbanization that is going to happen in India, 400 million people are going to move from Indian villages to cities in the next two or three decades.
It's interesting, isn't it, that something similar was happening in England, and we had Dickens and Trollope, for example, to record it. I think this task has fallen upon you.
Well, I that may be putting it a little grandly, I fear, but I think the point is a good one, which is that many countries have gone through this period of early industrialization. And so one can be both pessimistic and optimistic about India's future. The pessimism is that this is a really difficult period. It's formative. You've got to do lots of very hard things as you try and stop being a poor agrarian society and become a sort of middle income, reasonably successful urban society. Some countries have done this in Southeast Asia, for instance, but many countries have failed. But it's also true that if you look at America in the 1860s or South Korea in the 1960s, they all went through a stage that was similar to this, and they came out the other side. They managed to find a way beyond it. And so there is a sense that one can be, for all of its many challenges, one can be optimistic about India in theory, because, you know, they are overcoming challenges that other people have gone through before, and America is a good example of that.
To go back to my mention in Dispatches of Dickens and Trollope, let me ask you this question. Are there Indian writers who are trying to describe what you're describing? In other words, are there fiction writers in India who will turn this into literature?
Oh, yes. I mean, India is a highly literate society, and so many of the world's best novelists are Indian. I mean, look at the list of the Booker Prize for the last two decades, and you see Salman Rushdie, Kiran Desai. Kiran Desai's The Inheritance of Loss is a wonderful book about these kind of changes. So there hasn't been a particular novel in the vein of Dickens that I know that deals particularly with billionaires. But if you're looking for the grand, sweeping, a social novel, then there are many of these things. The one that I would recommend to your listeners is a novel by a Canadian Indian called Rohinton Mystery. It's called A Fine Balance, and it's one of the most, it's Dickensian in its sweep. It's a big, thick book that covers generations and has many characters, and it's a book of enormous, profound insight into a society that has a similar sweep to something like Dickens and Trollope. It's really magnificent.
James, tell us about the Branson of Bangalore.
So you're talking about Vijay Mallya, and so of all of the figures that that embody India's Gilded Age, and Vijay Mallya is the most fun and one of the most controversial. So if you are listening to this program, then you mentioned the Branson of Bangalore, so Bangalore, the southern tech capital, but he's a little bit like the cross between Richard Branson and Hugh Hefner, or perhaps Jack Sparrow from the movies, the piratical figure. And so he was a brewer, an airline tycoon. He founded Kingfisher Beer. Many of your listeners may have had a Kingfisher beer over a curry in a pub. He founded Kingfisher Airlines. And so the story that I tell of India, which is one of extraordinary growth, reglobalization, and investment, was one that he was part of. He spent a lot of money building up his airline and other businesses. And then the wheels fell off. And that's also part of India's story. So more recently, India, a lot of these businesses got into trouble. They borrowed too much, spent too much, and got into a pickle. And so Mallya fled India, and the bailiffs were about to catch up with him, and so he fled to London, and he now lives in exile in a luxurious mansion in central London, and the Indians are trying to bring him home, claiming that he behaved in a corrupt way, which is something that he denies. And so in the book, I got to meet him in his huge mansion in London, and he let me talk to him for 3 or 4 hours about his life story. And he claimed that he had been, wronged in all of this process, but he was a very talkative fellow, and so his story is a big part of the book.
I didn't realise that, he belongs to what you describe as one of London's more notorious fraternities, a club of Indian billionaires, the emigre moguls who were in Britain following scandals.
That's right. There's a few of these guys. Three or four really famous ones, but actually a few more than that if you get into the second tier. So there are a lot of Indians in London. It's their home from home. So the Indian rich, typically because of the weather in the summer in India when it's stinking hot, they go off to London and enjoy watching Wimbledon and going to the races and that sort of thing. But some of them, if they get into trouble in India, they, in a sense, seek asylum of a sort in the UK. And so that's true for Vijay Mallya. It's true for the guy who set up the Indian Premier League cricket tournament, for those of your fans who are cricket tragics. There's a couple of others. And so, in a sense, this has become a problem for relations between the UK and the US, because India now, in effect, sees the UK not as a tax haven, but as a sort of Indian criminal haven. They feel that the UK is providing a kind of haven for these corrupt billionaires. The UK sees it rather differently, which is that, these people turn up and then there has to be due process of law, and you can't just chuck them out because they're not very popular in India. But anyway, it's been a source of tension between India and the UK that you have these famous fugitive billionaires holed up in London trying to escape the Indian authorities, including Vijay Mallya, who's the most famous of them.
Well, he has said India has corruption running in its veins, and it's not something one is going to change overnight. One of the problems you identify as absolutely central to the billionaire Raj is, yes, crony capitalism, that symbiotic relationship between the titans of industry and the country's politician. And Australians will be thrilled that you've devoted an entire chapter of your book to the controversial ties between Adani and Modi. As you must be aware, this is a very, very big issue in this country.
Yeah, Gautam Adani in many ways embodies the story of India's billionaire Raj. He's one of the three billionaires I profile in the beginning of the book. His rise was in many ways the most spectacular. He was a new figure. No one had ever heard of this guy. And then within a 5-year period, he went from being pretty much a nobody to being one of the top 10 billionaires in India. And so his growth was even more staggering than everybody else. And in a sense, the story that he has got into trouble for in Australia reflects that. So the scale of this mine and other facilities that he's trying to build in the northeast of your country in Queensland, I mean, it's a staggeringly huge project, so $16, $17 billion. And it embodies all of the things that he's famous for, you know, incredible ambition, huge growth, and then getting into big trouble because he kind of pushes the regulatory authorities and the perception is that he's not kind of playing by the rules properly. Now, he would deny that, but he's a very controversial figure for the way that he has expanded his businesses in India, also because he's perceived to be very close to the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. So it doesn't surprise me in a sense that Adani, by virtue of his aggression and his ambition, has become a controversial figure in Australia as he is in India.
As you point out, Adani and Modi enjoy at least a marriage of convenience. Any sign that Modi might be starting to distance himself a little?
Well, so Adani's relationship with Modi goes back to their early years. They were both from the same state in India, which is called Gujarat in the northwest of the country. They came of age as respectively politician and businessman at about the same time in the middle of the 2000s. And so they rose to become national figures together. Their relationship is a bit more distant now. Modi cannot be seen politically to be too close to these tycoons because they have become politically toxic. And so, yes, Modi has distanced himself from Adani as he has from many of the tycoons with whom he may have been associated, because these figures, the people I call the billionaire Raj, are to some degree politically toxic in India. And so you can't be seen to be too close to them. Underneath, you never really know what's going on. I mean, India can be quite an opaque place. And so it may, you know, it's hard to tell what the relationship is between companies like Adani and politicians like Modi behind the scenes. People have their suspicions, but it's very hard to know exactly what's going on.
So, of course, Modi is at the heart of your book as well, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I started out to write a book about billionaires and the super rich, but eventually I realized that, you know, you can't really grapple with contemporary India without dealing properly with its political system. And as you say, so crony capitalism means the collusion between the business and political elite. And so if you want to write about cronyism, you have to write about politics too. And Narendra Modi is the overwhelmingly dominant figure of the current moment in India. And so I have a couple of chapters on Modi as well. What sort of politician is he? What are we to make of his brand of populist religious nationalism? And in a sense, the interrelationship between money and politics in India. So India is the world's largest democracy, and that's part of the reason why your listeners in Australia and, you know, my people in the UK, in the US, they should care about India, in large part because it is a parliamentary democracy with liberal rights. But it has at its heart this very problematic relationship between business and politics, where it's on its course to be the world's most expensive democracy, but all of the money the political parties raise, billions and billions of dollars, that's all raised illegally. And that has to come from business. We don't know exactly how or who or what the quid pro quo is. But in addition to all of the other problems that India grapples with about corruption and graft and cronyism, you have this central problem of the funding of politics, where you might say there's too much money in Australian politics. There's certainly too much in American politics. But at least typically we know who's funding whom and to what degree and where the money's come from. The problem in India is we have no idea who's funding whom. And that creates a real problem for the relationship between business and politics. And voters have no idea, you know, who's beholden to whom.
Over the years, this program has visited India on a number of occasions. In our most recent attempt, we were denied visas, so we went ahead anyway and did the programs out of Sydney. But we found a great many very important Indian commentators were uneasy about, you know, about criticizing the government. Did you find it easy to get people to talk?
It's very difficult. People are uneasy both to criticize the government to criticize the big billionaires. You know, they're both very powerful. So there are critics of the government, and I could go and talk to them. There are plenty of people out there who'll say they don't like Narendra Modi. You know, India is a free society and a spirited democracy. And so it's not as if it's kind of cowed by the government. But business people, for instance, will not speak out against the government because they know the government has the power to punish them. And often people are very wary about criticizing business people. I mean, there are a number of people who have said that my book is quite brave because it goes after, to some degree, figures like Mr. Ambani. Now, I don't think that's true. I think I am given a degree of protection because I'm a foreigner. I don't live there anymore. You know, there's not very much that they can do to me. But there are many, the people in India who do criticize the tycoons and the politicians. You know, there is real bravery in India. The system is not weighted in favor of the little guy. You do not have quite the same robust legal protections that you would have in a country like Australia. And so those people who are kind of campaigners for sort of justice or who go after corporate corruption, those people are really brave, and I admire them a great deal for what they do.
James, despite the problems of cronyism, corruption, rising inequality, ultranationalism, you end your book on a fairly optimistic note. Why?
Well, a number of reasons. I mean, first, Indians in general are a remarkably talented lot. Just look everywhere in the world, apart from India, and you'll find Indians on top of the heap. Hinduism is America's second richest religion after Judaism. The Indians are America's richest ethnic minority. That's true even here in Singapore. Everywhere Indians go, pretty much, they're enormously successful. And eventually, that will be true in India too. India has particular problems of, its government doesn't work very well, and there are problems in its business community. But this is an enormously talented and resourceful nation of a huge size that will have an enormous impact on the next century, particularly here in Asia. And just go back to my central analogy with the Gilded Age in America. If you were to have sat in, you mentioned Fifth Avenue in New York in 1880, you looked around you and you would have seen a country that appeared to be fundamentally broken. It was rapacious tycoons only in it for themselves, rampantly corrupt politics. Nothing really worked. If you literally look at a picture, street scene, of Manhattan, downtown Manhattan in about that period, it looks very much like Mumbai today. And yet, over the next sort of 20, 30, 40 years, a number of things happened in America, which meant that the middle class began to take control of politics. Corruption was to some degree removed from the political system. New institutions were founded. A whole slew of changes. And in particular, there were campaigns for progressive reform. And so in theory, I don't see any reason why that can't happen in India. My book lays out a number of things that I think are necessary conditions. It won't happen by accident. It's not going to be easy. India is not in the best position in all respects. But I think, there are reasons to be optimistic. One certainly shouldn't start from the position that sort of all is lost. I think there's good reason to think that India is going to be a successful and certainly very influential country for the rest of this century.
And on that happy note, James, I thank you. James Crabtree, journalist, author, associate professor in practice at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore. And his new book, which I'm holding up to the microphone so you can all see it, is The Billionaire Raj, A Journey Through India's New Gilded Age, published by One World. Thanks, James.